This is On and Off Your Mat Podcast, episode 217, Healing as a Whole Body Experience. If you've been dealing with chronic pain or tend to get injured easily, and you are starting to feel frustrated or impatient with your body, or even generally discouraged around your capacity to heal, today's episode is for you. For today's episode, I sat down with Jonathan Fitzgordon. Jonathan is the creator of the Rejuvenation Movement Method, which was born from his own pain and healing journey and aims to help people age gracefully and live pain-free lives. Jonathan has been practicing yoga since 1995, teaching since 2000, and training teachers since 2005. He owns and operated the Yoga Center of Brooklyn from 2001 to 2009, and he is the creator of the Core Working Program, Psoas Release Party, and the Be Your Own Healer Program. Today, we sat down to talk about healing, particularly when you are highly sensitive or hypermobile, how to approach healing from a whole body perspective, including posture, walking patterns, and nervous system regulation. If this episode inspires you in any way, share it and help someone else on their journey towards getting out of pain for good. I always love to read your takeaways on the episode, so take a screenshot and share something you've learned on IG. Make sure to tag at On and Off Your Mat Podcast or erica.belanger to make sure I see them and I can reshare you. Before we get to today's episode, I have one more reminder regarding Recharge, Reconnect, and Reset, the retreat. It is less than 1 month away now. And for the last stretch and my last minute people, I'm adding a free gift, little cherry on top when you join. For the last 5 spots that are available, you will receive a free massage at the hotel spa during your retreat stay, just to supercharge your relaxation, your self-care, and the powerful healing capacity of touch. It's time to claim your spot and your massage before they're all gone and it's too late. This retreat is like getting 3 months of coaching with me packed in 7 days. You'll learn all my favorite mind, body, spirit, nervous system, and self-care practices, how to drop your hustle lifestyle, melt your stress and anxiety away, and transform your life from the inside out. If you're a sensitive soul or you're a yogi and you're ready to take time and space to put yourself first, to cater to your needs, and to learn how you can return to your life feeling rejuvenated and equipped to make it last, this is going to be life-changing for you. You can go to ericabelanger.com/retreat for all the juicy details you need, or you can send me an email or a DM and we'll talk if you have any questions, concerns, or anything before you're ready to hop in. All right. If you're ready to jump into today's episode with Jonathan, let's go. It's going to be a good one. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Erica. Thanks for having me on your show.
Thank you so much for joining me today. For our listeners that don't know you yet, can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and your journey?
Sure. So it's Jonathan Fitzgordon, and I'm the creator of the Core Walking Program, the Psoas Release Party, and a number of other pain relief solutions. And I like to say that I was my first client where I started doing yoga in my early 30s. I actually did it when I was 6 and 7. Didn't care for it that much then. But when I went back in my 30s, I was just home. It resonated with me. And my physical story is I am fairly hypermobile, pretty loose in my joints. So in my 30s, I excelled at yoga and I was able to do really cool tricks and feet behind the head and things like that. But after 2 years, my knees started to go south and I really suffered in that way. And I ended up having 3 knee surgeries. After the 3rd surgery, I was ready to get back on the mat. And a teacher said, "So what are you doing to prevent a 4th surgery?" That was my wake up moment. I really heard that. And I said, "Oh, I'm not doing anything. I'll be back." And that's when I started learning about posture and movement and how to do yoga correctly. Alignment wasn't really a thing in the yoga I did when I was in my 30s. And it all grew out of that.
I love that question from the teacher because it's so gentle, yet so confronting. It's a very good way to be like, can we talk about something?
That's exactly right. And, you know, it was the height of knee surgeries, like meniscus surgeries was super popular at the moment. And I mean, there's an argument to be made that I could have maybe avoided one of the 3, but I actually think they were all pretty necessary. But they were life-changing. I really don't regret them at all. And I actually think in many ways, they were the best thing that ever happened to me.
It's funny sometimes how the challenges we face put us on a path of who we're supposed to be and like finding purpose and mission and all these things, because you wouldn't be teaching about this today if you hadn't gone through that yourself.
Yeah, no question about it. I found my calling in my own suffering. And I don't even know why I became a yoga teacher. I was a carpenter at a yoga center and I did a lot of yoga. And the owner said, you should be a teacher. And I was like, it's not so interesting to me. But she made it very affordable for me to do the training. And I met my wife in that training. And all sorts of good things came out of that. So I'm super appreciative, even though I did not see it as what I'd be doing with the rest of my life.
Sure. It's always incredible how when you take a step back, you see how everything unfolds in your life, where in the moment you had no idea that, you know, this one particular step might create a whole different life. You mentioned that you were hypomobile, and I know that we're talking about pain and healing, and it could be more difficult for hypermobile people to heal injuries or to heal pain in their bodies. Why is that?
For the most part, most hypermobile people don't know they're hypermobile. Mm-hmm. Many, many people who suffer with pain issues don't know that their pain is a result of hypermobility. There are many levels of hypermobility. Like, I would say I'm on the low end of the spectrum, actually. Like, I hyperextend my knees and my fingers, and I can do silly things, but not my elbows. And there's actually like a rating and a score. So I'm sort of on the low end. And then you have a way more intense end, like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and people that suffer a completely different way. But even people who, like with Ehlers-Danlos, where it's very clear there's something going on in terms of their excess mobility, they sometimes have to fight for a diagnosis. Like, mobility as a thing is not necessarily on the radar for a lot of doctors and pain professionals.
So you think because it's not on the radar, that's why people have more trouble getting help with the consequences of their hypermobility. So we're talking about pain from the joint perspective mostly.
Well, it's very interesting. When I say they're not getting help, they are getting treated in very traditional ways. Mm. And traditional ways often just don't serve the hypermobile. So you could be on that kind of hamster wheel of pain issues for years and years and years, getting treated in very traditional ways that if you're hypermobile, those traditional pathways are just not going to serve you at all.
Yeah, because it's not addressing the issue, the root cause of the pain. It's treating the symptom, which in the end is not going to help you long term.
That's correct. And, you know, to be honest, because I work with so many different people, those solutions do work for a lot of people, even the hypermobile. That some people just go through the traditional methodology, injections, physical therapy, surgery. Sometimes those things do work. And even though you're hypermobile, you're going to still get healed. It's just that I like to look at it as 80-20. There are 20% of the population that are not going to find that sort of benefit. And hypermobility is one of the things I work with a lot. And sensitivity is another one. And they're very interlinked, but they can also be distinct. But highly sensitive people, like as a diagnosis, HSP, same kind of game where people come to me for all different reasons, but it turns out often they are both hypermobile and highly sensitive. And the highly sensitive fall under the radar in a very similar way to hypermobile people.
Is that more linked to the sensitivity in their nervous system than it is in like the over flexibility or mobility they might have?
Absolutely. So they can be connected. So like people with Ehlers-Danlos are both going to be hypermobile and have sensitivity issues. And I might be on the opposite end of the spectrum. If you ask my wife, she'll tell you I'm completely insensitive. Again, there's just a wide spectrum for all of these things. But again, those two different diagnoses, highly sensitive people and hypermobility, the 20% of the population that fall into those categories tend to be the people I work with.
Mm-hmm. What makes it more difficult to heal if you compare someone that's highly sensitive to someone that's not sensitive? What happens that the healing process can be more challenging?
Well, that's a great question. On the simplest level, I would say medications, right? Where some people can go in and be given anti-inflammatory medications or cortisone injections and react very well to them. Someone who's highly sensitive is much less likely to react well to medications. So the sensitivity in the nervous system often translates into a sensitivity to medications. And then when you go to a doctor and that's their purview, which is either to give medicines or shots or surgery, and you don't react to what they're offering, they don't have a box to think outside of.
Yeah, they're kind of limited into like, oh, this is the symptoms, this is the pill I'll give you. But then if that doesn't work, that was my case. I suffer from chronic illness and chronic pain. And for years, the only solution was, you know, Percocet and Oxy. And if I didn't want that, they were like, well, you're on your own then. Like, good luck. Come see us when you're ready to take, you know, those pills. So there's oftentimes a lack of support and thinking outside the box and seeing the body as a whole, really. Because if you're only looking at like that one symptom of pain, you might be missing the source. You might be missing something like the nervous system and its role in all of this. So I was wondering, how do we think of healing as a whole body experience, even if it seems, because often that's the case, that it's location specific, right? You have knee pain or you have back pain or you have pain in this one area of your body. How do we stop looking at just this little point of view and kind of back off and look at the whole picture?
You know, when I was first studying yoga and I finished my first teacher training, I did a number of these, they were called yoga therapy trainings. And I had a really great teacher. I wasn't even working with pain relief clients at the time, but he said to me something that stuck with me, which is, you will never help somebody from the place of their pain. That if they have lower back pain, addressing the lower back is not what you're going to need to do. I will be honest, that in many ways, I'm a very slow learner. And it took me a long time to really process what that meant. But that is part of when I feel like I'm taking a very holistic approach to what I do. The main work I do is with posture and walking.
Mm-hmm.
I do that because of how universal those things are for everybody.
Yeah, we all do them.
Yeah, exactly. We do them a lot. Even the most sedentary person is probably taking 3,000 steps a day. And if you can make those good steps, that's going to really help. And when I first started looking at my own issues, it was just shocking to see how poorly I walked and how poorly I stood. And then from a yoga perspective, which is a really interesting thing, I worked with a yoga teacher this morning and I said, show me your regular posture, which she did. I said, then now show me Tadasana, which she did. And I said, do you think your Tadasana made your posture better or worse? Immediately, she said, better. And I said, well,
actually,
that's it. What I do is I take pictures, you know, I'll take screenshots, and I was able to show her these two versions of really bad posture. And that the Tadasana actually made the posture worse, because there's a universal instruction in the world, which is lift your chest and take your shoulders back. That's how people are teaching Tadasana. And it's how parents are teaching children. And if you're, you know, in the military, it's just a very standard approach to standing. And I think it's a terrible, terrible instruction. And in large part, my whole goal is to get people out of that position. And that position, it affects the breath, it affects the lower spine, it affects the hips. So it's a very literally a holistic approach I'm taking. We can even say I'm starting with the pelvis before I even start with posture.
So what does it mean? What does it look like to stand properly and walk properly? What do we do with our pelvis? Where do we start?
So it's great. I'm teaching a neutral pelvis. So most people, they might have an anterior tilt to the pelvis, which means their butt is stuck out too far, and you might have too much of a curve in your lower back, or a posterior tilt to the pelvis where it's tucked under. And most people fall into one of those two categories. So I'm trying to find the middle ground. But then in terms of posture, I think most people are sinking their thighs forward. They like lean forward into their thighs, and that can misalign your pelvis. It can keep your pelvis tucked. It can keep your pelvis stuck out, but it can also misalign it in different ways. So the first thing I'm trying to do with everybody is get the legs underneath the hips. And I'm using a very traditional approach. You know, most people have heard about the idea of the plumb line through the skeleton, that we want to line up the ears and the shoulders and the hips and the knees, kind of just where I'm trying to get everybody. And I do it with an endless series of cues to help you change your posture. And, you know, if one cue doesn't work, I'll give you five more until we find something that really resonates with people.
Do you find it's easy for people to actually feel where is that neutral pelvis when they're so accustomed to being one way and thinking that they're actually in neutral pelvis?
So that's a great question. Pain is the great incentive. So that when someone stands up and they are standing in what they think is straight, and I say, well, are you in pain as you're standing? And sometimes they are, sometimes they're not, but there's always some sense of discomfort they might be able to find, whether it's in the knee or the glutes or the lower back. And then I put them into really a distinction I make between old you posture and new you posture. And I put you into new you posture. And then I just ask, how do you feel differently? And sometimes I have to go back and forth a number of times because it really is about compare and contrast. But it's kind of amazing that that shift from old you to new you is going to provide a change. Very often it's not even pain. They'll just say, oh, wow, my lower back feels much more spacious.
Stable.
Stable, exactly. So one of the things is a lot of people I work with are kind of older. And depending upon how old you are, you know, I'm 60 now. And if I was starting today, trying to change 60 years of patterning,
it'll take a minute.
Yeah, it's not going to happen in a minute. It takes a while and it takes patience and perseverance. It actually serves pretty well to have a little OCD. And, you know, if you really like focusing on things, it's helpful. So it's a very interesting process. Again, I start with that idea of neutral pelvis. Like when it comes to walking, it's so interesting because I date myself sometimes with the picture of Keep on Truckin' by R. Crumb, which is like a hippie image of a guy leaning backwards and kicking his legs out when he walks. If you lean backwards with your upper body and lean forward with your lower body, you're never really having your pelvis in neutral when you walk. But the design of walking is that, you know, the pelvis is super active. It tilts and rotates when we're walking, but it wants to do that through neutral. And this gets a little technical, right? So you want to go from neutral to anterior to neutral to posterior over and over and over again. But if you're not starting in neutral, you're going from sort of like posterior to half neutral.
Very posterior to a little posterior.
That's exactly it. You're never hitting that center line from which we have to process through.
That is like, if you go on a walk and you're like, okay, I'm going to focus on moving my pelvis forward, center, back, or back, forward, center, back and forth. This on its own is like walking meditation because you have to pay so much attention.
It's totally true. But I will be honest. I rarely tell people to feel that way. I just say, stick your butt out and lean forward. And they say, that feels so weird. We'll get a video of them and we'll start looking at that video and they go, oh, it doesn't look as weird as it feels. So in large part, what I'm really teaching is perception. It starts with, if you stand up straight and I say stand up straight, you think you're straight when you're actually leaning backwards. And I think everybody is leaning backwards slightly. So if that's what you think is straight, and then I straighten you up, you think you're leaning forward. So then the game is not really what's good posture. It's where do I think I am in space?
Yeah. So we start with awareness, one of where we are to begin. Then we work on our perception. Then we realign the body. What happens from there?
Well, the best thing is when someone gets out of pain immediately, it happens on occasion. But like I said, I'm taking a holistic approach. Sleep is a big part of what I'm working with people on. Sleep position. Sleep position is a huge piece of the puzzle. What you do for exercise and the way you exercise. And I am a yoga teacher now 25 years, 24 to be exact. And when I first started doing yoga, I honestly told people yoga is the only thing you ever need to do for the rest of your life. And now I no longer think that way. And I am encouraging people. I say, do five different things. You don't have to do them all an hour a day. Right. But I do yoga and I hike and I bike and I walk and I lift weights, and you can't do too much. And very often, like, to be honest, biking is my favorite of all my exercises these days. It's the most meditative for me. It has really rebuilt my spine in ways I didn't expect. But anytime I get a biking client, the first thing I say is, if you are only biking, you got to add two or three other things. Because biking in and of itself, I think, is honestly a pretty bad exercise.
So it's about creating harmony by moving the body in all like directions, basically, and through all ranges of motion that are available.
That's exactly right. And while biking is great, what I don't like about it, it's not weight bearing. It doesn't twist the upper body as much as it should. But if you bike and you do yoga and you hike, in those three activities, you are going to be using your body in so many varied dynamic ways. And then you're doing it in this new you posture. It all starts to add up really, really well.
Yeah. In my experience, weight training was super important because the more I did yoga, the more joint pain I had. And when I started to weight train and create more stability in my end range, the pain went away, some of it.
No, absolutely. Especially as we age, especially for women as they age and postmenopausal and perimenopausal weights. I can't speak too highly about weights, which I am very late to the game. And why I am late to the game in weights was because my hypermobility, I always got injured.
Same. I got injured so many times.
With free weights, I keep getting injured. And what's interesting is on my bike path, about 2 years ago, they installed these machines right out on the path. Like one day I'm biking and the next day there's like an outdoor gym and they're push and pull machines. You can't really change the weight. And I decided to start using those. And at first I got injured with those. But then it was great because it wasn't about like, am I moving the weights wrong because they were fixed? It's what am I doing with my joints? And I had to kind of rearrange my elbows a little bit and I got past that pain. And then consistently using those machines allowed me to get my first set of free weights and kettlebells that I was then able to start performing without pain. And it's really interesting because I had given up and I said, all right, look, my wife is really big on weightlifting and she goes to the gym 6 days a week and tries to get me to go. And I'm always like, no, they're going to hurt me. And now, you know, it took me a long while, but now they are an absolute essential part of my routine. And I have learned how to do them without pain. But, you know, for someone who's been a professional at this for 20 years, that it took me so long just speaks to how difficult doing these things correctly can be. And especially if you add hypermobility to the equation.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you have a bit of numbness or like you're not very sensitive, or a lot of highly sensitive people actually become numb over time because it's so much that they shut those senses down, then you lose that connection with your body and you can't even tell that your joint is in a funky position or you're like totally misaligned. Like you're not feeling that, you know, interoception and proprioception aspects of how you move, and it makes it easy or more easy to get injured because you're lacking that awareness too.
There's no question about it. And the truth is, not everyone wants to hear about their nervous system. And for a lot of people, that's the main thing I'm working with, which is I want you to be able to exercise. I want you to be able to do as much as I do, but we have to kind of get a little order to your nervous system and bring some homeostasis, balance between the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. But, you know, I work with athletes and they're just not as easy to get into that world. They just want to go, look, help me run faster. And I'm very willing to do that. It's just that I keep trying to figure out, even as I'm doing this, I need to get you to understand your nervous system. And one of the main things about that is the aging component, because it doesn't matter where you are in your 40s and 50s in terms of athletics and pain. But when we want to age gracefully and we want to age successfully, the nervous system has got to become a piece of it. And I'm not trying to minimize trauma, but I think we're all traumatized to one degree or another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sensitive people take on trauma in a different way than people that aren't as sensitive. But I do believe that we all have a childhood to look back on and environmental things to look back on, so that no matter who you are as my client, if you might come to me just to improve your run, I am going to try to figure out a way to get in there and try to give you help with your nervous system.
So what do we need to know about our nervous system and how it functions to look at our healing from that holistic point of view or perspective?
So there are many divisions within the nervous system, but I mainly look at two, which is the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. So your sympathetic nervous system is excitation. The flight or fight response is part of that system. And the parasympathetic nervous system is relaxation. The harmony of those two systems is homeostasis. That's what we're looking for. But for the most part, everyone I'm working with, and I really do believe, like I say, everyone to one degree or another in the world is overloaded in the sympathetic nervous system. I refer to it as being stuck in the sympathetic nervous system. So one, you can use any of many scenarios. Growing up in a war zone, growing up in a bad neighborhood where you fear for being beaten up or mugged, growing up in an emotionally volatile home, growing up in an abusive home, all of these are factors that can lead us to getting stuck in the sympathetic nervous system, which is protective and wonderfully important. And then if somebody is stuck in their sympathetic nervous system, they have to be introduced to meditation, relaxation. The work I do is release work, mostly through a muscle called the psoas. And if you can learn how to release tension from your body, long-held tension, and this gets a little woo-woo.
We love woo-woo.
Yeah, exactly, right? The energy that a body cannot process. Let's say another trauma is getting hit by a car. That's something that happens fast and furious. And your brain and nervous system can only handle so much in that moment. So what it can handle, I believe, gets stored in the psoas muscle. And, you know, I've had teachers say, you know, you're an idiot because it's a muscle and muscles don't hold on to emotions. I say, you know, but I put people into these release poses. You can't imagine what happens to their body. And they go, yeah, but it's still a muscle. And I respect them completely. You know, I try to respect everyone in their viewpoints. So when we are stuck in the sympathetic nervous system, and I think to one degree or another, we all are, it's about technique and what techniques you use to get out of it. So meditation is a really valid one. Asana yoga is another valid one. I use release exercises because I do believe you have to start somewhere and you have to get some sense of ease in the nervous system to be able to apply all of the other things. In my heart of hearts, would I like to be able to say to somebody, just stand well and walk well and your nervous system is going to get taken care of?
That's more like maintenance. You know, it's not going to heal past trauma that you've been holding on, because I do believe like you that the body, you know, keeps score of what has happened energetically. And we're more than just muscles and bones. Like there's so many layers of our energetic body or emotional body. So yeah, I think it's more complicated for sure.
It is. It's funny. I'm trying to make things as not complicated as possible, you know, but I did decide early on that when I started my first program, which is the core walking program, I said, I got to teach some anatomy. Like nobody knows how their body works. And if I can show you that your foot has a design and it's supposed to do this with every step you take, it's going to be much easier to do it. But I'm doing that in a very basic way. And I'm teaching the nervous system in a very basic way. But I really do think that the science of it helps people process as much as the physical nature of it.
Yeah, it helps people make sense of things. Like we're very cognitive, you know, creatures, and we want to understand things to then trust that it's worth for us to do. So sometimes we need to get a little bit into like the technicalities of things and the whys of things to then be like, okay, I'm willing to take this different path and this different route. Now, I know for a lot of our listeners, like relaxation, meditation, those are tools they know already. Would you give us an example of how we can release the psoas? Because that might be new for people.
There is one pose in particular that I think is the best thing ever to happen to the world. And it's called constructive rest position. And it doesn't matter who you are and what context I work with you. I'm going to try to get you to do this for 15 minutes a day. And I have clients that are doing it for 3 hours a day that is sitting on the couch with their partner or spouse at night. They hit constructive rest on the floor and watch TV if you need to. I'd rather you not. But I tell the story of a client many years ago who installed a television on his ceiling so he could lay in this position. And whatever works, you know, it's all good. When I do constructive rest, I just close my eyes or leave them open softly. And that's sort of my meditation, though it's not literally meditation. But constructive rest is laying on your back with your knees bent, your feet flat to the floor. Tying a belt around your thighs is a good idea, just so that you don't have to think about them too much. And crazy things happen to certain people. The legs start flopping side to side. The body starts to undulate, quake. It can get really weird. But, you know, for the most part, that doesn't happen. But it's a psoas release. You know, there are certain muscles in the body that are just on 24/7. If your pelvic floor muscles weren't working, you would be peeing all night long. We don't want to do that. So we have tone in our pelvic floor muscles. The psoas is a postural muscle. Anytime you're standing, or it's the main muscle of walking. Anytime you're moving, you're using it. Main muscle is standing, because the psoas created the lumbar curve and helps us to stand upright. So this position, constructive rest, is actually one of the very few things we can put our body into to actually let the psoas completely relax. One of the teachers who told me I was, you know, stupid for thinking this about the psoas, her phrase was to put the muscle on the slack. So you're actually just giving the psoas a chance to relax.
You're shortened because your knee is bent and there's no weight carrying.
That's exactly it. I look at them as gravitational releases. You're just letting the weight of gravity pour down upon this muscle. And then sometimes, not all the time, sometimes things just start going haywire and you really feel that release of energy. Other times people come back to me and say, well, I've been doing it every day for 2 weeks and I feel nothing. I can say two things. One, it doesn't mean nothing is happening. But another weird thing about trauma is, you mentioned the Bessel van der Kolk book, The Body Keeps the Score. There's another book I really love by a woman, Therese Bertharach, called The Body Has Its Reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I can say, look, you need the body to let go of this unprocessed energy. But just because I tell you to sit there doesn't mean your body is actually ready.
Yeah.
And when the body is ready, it will do it. But you got to sometimes spend a lot of time setting it up to allow that release to happen. And you have to honor that, which can be frustrating, I know.
And I also think there's a part of consent. Like, you have to actually be willing to. Like, maybe your body's not ready, but maybe your mental's not ready. And you have to talk yourself through, like, it's okay to relax. It's okay to let go. Like, sometimes, and being open and verbally and out loud sometimes saying yes to what you're doing is actually super powerful in allowing the body to know what it knows how to do, but for some reason it's not doing. I think that's also an interesting tool to kind of play with. Self-consent.
No, I think that is a huge piece of the puzzle. I don't actually frame it that way, but I love hearing it phrased that way, because there are no guarantees that any of these things work. And the name of, like, my private program is called Be Your Own Healer, because I'm sitting on Zoom and you're in another country or in another city, and I can only help you so far. But for these techniques to work, you have to become the master of your own fate. And in the beginning, this is many years ago, I was very lucky to have a lot of yoga students be willing to, like, get put through my mill. I would see people not healing. And it's not that I lack compassion or empathy, but I just didn't understand at the time. And I'm like, well, you're doing everything I tell you. You should be better. And then you start to realize the mind is powerful, and we're only going to get better when we're ready to get better, or when we're in the environment that we can give ourselves consent.
Yeah, we feel safe enough.
That's exactly right. And if we can't, you have to honor that as well, which is not, from a practitioner's standpoint, that's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, sometimes you have to teach people how to create safety, how to kind of befriend our system in that way, where they might need a bit of self-compassion and then self-acceptance first, that things are not moving that fast. So they need more patience with their own body. Because if you have, like, friction and, like, you're bullying yourself into, like, you need to heal, that might not also, you know, put you on the fastest road to healing.
No question. And then what if you are working with someone who thinks you should be healing, you know, and if I'm sitting there giving somebody attitude saying, I'm telling you what to do, you should be better.
Oh, yeah. It's so not helpful.
Mm-hmm. And to learn to take that step back and give people the space to find it on their own, even though we all want it yesterday. It's just that's the way it works. But, you know, one of the things I talk about, not in pain, that's not even about the nervous system, but you can look at it the same way. Pain really affects people in many different ways. I say, look, if you are 1% better, you're on the road to recovery. The 100%, you have no idea how long that's going to take. You know, if you have a sprained ankle, you know, it's a pretty good bet that in 14 days, you're going to be back. Your swelling's down, your pain is down, you're ready to move on. But for some, it could take 6 months or 8 months. And that fear of I'm never going to be better is so powerful and overwhelming. That goes physical and nervous system. So I do like to say, you know, 1% better means you're moving in the right direction. Doesn't mean you're not going to move backwards again, because that's also part of the process. But how do you learn to trust in healing and to stay on the path, even though the path can look dark? It's hard.
Yeah, it's hard. And that's a real question people need to ask themselves. I personally like to tell the story because I think it gives perspective. When I committed to healing, because, you know, sometimes you kind of dabble in it for years and nothing really happens, right? When I committed to healing, it took me 3 months. For 3 months, doing all the things every day, it did nothing. 3 months and one day, I woke up that morning and I was like, oh, I have no pain. Oh, okay. It's working. But for 3 months, nothing seemed like it was working or happening. Something was happening, obviously, in the background, but I couldn't just pick up on that subtlety yet. I needed like a bigger shift to notice it. And that's not easy. It's not easy to not quit and be like, it's not working. Let me try something else. Let me go to the next shiny kind of solution that someone is promising.
Yeah, no question about it. And having compassion for oneself is really difficult, right? And it's also, you know, from the perspective of somebody who comes to work with me, no one, for the most part, is coming to me first. They're coming after multiple doctors, sometimes multiple surgeries, and then their faith in healing is gone, right? That I have to say, well, I also don't necessarily know that I have the answer. And I can promise you it's going to take a lot of patience. That is not what they're interested in hearing. They're interested in healing. That's a whole nother level to building trust and building the faith that even though nothing else has worked, I know you're still Googling at 3 o'clock in the morning. So you found me. So you still have some faith that you can get better, but there's still so many layers
of doubt and frustration and a fear. Yeah, it's not simple for sure. I love this conversation, but we will wrap it up. Is there anything else you want to add before we finish? Like if there's one takeaway in this whole chat we had today, what would you like listeners to leave with?
Since we touched on constructive rest position, I would say Google constructive rest. If you Google it with the word core walking after this, there's many blog posts about constructive rest. You can find mine if you just I have many. Make that your best friend, pain or no pain. It is an incredibly great tool to have in the toolbox of healing and aging.
Love it. I will put all your info in the show notes. But in the meantime, where's the best place for people to find you if they want to work with you in some way? You mentioned a few different cores. What's happening in your world?
Corewalking.com is my website, and you can check that out. And from there, you can see my blog. I have a YouTube channel. Like I have a lot of free resources that you can pretty much learn everything I talk about via my podcast, my YouTube channel, my blog. But then I also have streaming video programs. The SOAS Release Party is one of them, core walking program, the sciatica program, a plantar fasciitis program. And then to work with me privately is always going to be the most effective way to do that. And if you're interested in working with me privately, the best way to do that is to reach out to info@corewalking.com and we get on a phone call and have a short chat to see if we'd be a good fit to work together. I always want to know that I'll be able to help people when I take them on as clients.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much for your time today. That was a very, hopefully, helpful conversation for people to listen to today.
Thanks so much, Erica. It was really a pleasure meeting you. Thanks for having me on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today. Last call for Recharge, Reconnect, and Reset the Retreat, including your extra free massage during your stay, less than a month away, April 6th to 13. Check ericabelanger.com/retreat, DM me or email me for details. You'll find the show notes for this episode at ericabelanger.com/217. Before you go, I just want to say a last thank you to all the growing team behind this podcast, including all our premium members. Without you, I couldn't keep going. Once again, thank you for listening. See you next Monday.